Thank you very much. And thank you also to Barbara for inviting me here this afternoon. This really is a very wonderful and interesting meeting. I'm learning a great deal. So I think my job today is to talk about the continental lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary and also internal layering within continents. And I'd like to recognize Emily Hopper, Ved Lekic, and Heather Ford, who, as students and postdocs with me, performed a lot of the analyses from our group that I'll be showing. So the first thing I'd like to take a look at is how do the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundaries of old continents, cratons, differ from those in younger continental regions? And this will pick up on a lot of the themes that Lars talked about in his talk. This is just a very simplified schematic illustrating the notion that if temperature alone is controlling the contrast in seismic velocity between the lithosphere and asthenosphere, we're going to get a relatively gradual decrease in velocity, shear wave velocity in particular, as a function of depth. But if you introduce compositional differences, say a relatively dry and depleted lithosphere over a more hydrated and less depleted asthenosphere, we can generate a sharper contrast in seismic velocity, as shown in the brown line here. And then if one introduces a little bit of melt into the asthenosphere, one can get a vertically localized gradient that's very strong at the LAB. And so we'll be looking at differences in the LAB velocity gradient between cratons and younger continental regions. So I'm just going to show a couple of examples of STP receiver function results from young continents. And basically what I want you to take away from these is that pretty much everywhere we look in young continental regions, when you combine surface wave tomography and STP receiver functions, you get evidence for a relatively strong and localized velocity gradient. Both Kate and Stefan showed localized exceptions to this, and I will as well, but I think as a general rule, the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary beneath the young continents is pretty sharp. So again, people have already talked about the STP receiver function method. Here we're taking an array of STP phases recorded at a network of stations at the surface, and we project the STP energy back down to a three-dimensional grid of hypothetical scatterers within the crust and the mantle. And this is now showing a profile through one such three-dimensional image. This is now in Southern California. The red line shows the San Andreas Fault. Down here in the southern part of Southern California, the plate boundary is transtensional, as shown by the blue arrows here, and this profile runs right along the southern edge of the Salton Sea, where we have extension as well as strike-slip motion, as shown by the arrows here. So this profile goes right across the extending part of the plate boundary, so the zone of extension at the surface is shown by the magenta arrows. And this blue phase here is within the mantle. In all of these images, blue phases are going to correspond to a velocity drop with depth, such as one might expect between the lithosphere and the asthenosphere. And then the red energy corresponds to positive energy. A lot of this is coming from the crust mantle boundary, a velocity increase with depth. But at the relatively long periods of STP receiver functions, you often get some interference between the crustal phase and sedimentary arrivals from sedimentary layers within the crust. So, you know, to get the crust STP is really not the best method. But basically what I want to illustrate here is this relatively strong phase in the mantle. Why do we interpret this as the LAB, at least the seismological lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary? The reason is it correlates extremely well with surface wave tomography. So this is now a profile in exactly the same location. This is from the Rayleigh wave tomography of Rao and Forsyth. These are absolute shear velocities. So here we see a mantle lid, a seismically high velocity mantle lid. It's about 70 or 80 kilometers deep to the flanks of the rift. And then beneath the Salton Trough itself, it's hard to see. There actually is a very thin little somewhat high velocity mantle layer beneath the Moho there. And the depth of the base of the tomographically defined lithosphere correlates extremely well with the variation in LAB depth we see in the STP receiver functions. It's also somewhat startling to me how rapid the lateral transitions are. We see variations in LAB topography of about 30 kilometers that occur over 50 kilometers or less. And there are a lot of interesting things one can say about tectonics and geodynamics based on that. But that's not the focus of my talk today, so I'm going to move on. Okay, so another example of a very strong lithosphere-sinosphere boundary phase. This is now in Northern California. This is work by Heather Ford. This is this profile here that runs down the eastern side of the Great Valley. Very coherent LAB phase. This corresponds to about a 6% velocity drop in 20 kilometers or less. When we look on the western side of the San Andreas, that phase is largely gone. So again, I want to emphasize that on a local scale, sometimes we get essentially these lithosphere-sinosphere boundary phases disappearing. If you look at profiles that cross the San Andreas Fault, you see that that transition in LAB strength is very well correlated with the San Andreas, at least in Central California. And to me, this argues for a contrast in lithospheric properties across the fault and is evidence for relatively localized shearing beneath the strike-slip paint boundary all the way through the lithosphere. But again, that's not the focus of my talk today, so I'm going to move on and talk about larger scale features. Okay, so here's the larger scale. So this is now looking at the western U.S. The blue dots here and the purple dots here show the stations that we used in this study. The blue dots are the stations of the Earthscope Transportable Array, complemented by the higher density distribution of temporary deployments from individual PI groups. And we're looking at a profile here along the bold black line that corresponds to this profile here. Below, we're showing the absolute shear wave velocities from the Obrebsky et al. Model, and you see a transition between the relatively low velocities in the upper mantle and the sort of the well-defined asthenosphere in the tectonically active part of the western U.S. This extremely slow zone of shear velocities corresponds to the track of the Yellowstone hotspot. But then when we move across the edge of the Wyoming craton is this white outlined region here. It corresponds to a small Archean craton. We see very thick and fast velocities that extend to depths of 200 kilometers or more. Okay, now let's look at the S2P receiver functions. Essentially everywhere across the western U.S., with very few exceptions, we see a strong and coherent phase that correlates quite well with the tomographically defined lithosphere-sinosphere boundary. Again, this would correspond to about a 5%, 6% drop in velocity over 20 kilometers or less. When we get into the craton, the character of the S2P energy changes dramatically. And we first started seeing these images in the craton. I mean, quite honestly, the energy in here is fairly complicated and weak, and I didn't believe it. So what we did is we took our images, which are based on several tens of thousands, actually I think about 100,000 waveforms in this case, and we bootstrapped it. So what you're looking at here is an image which essentially is the mean of 50 random selections of our waveform data set. So we're looking at the mean, and we can compute the standard deviation. And everything which is a medium blue color and darker is actually a well-resolved phase. So these really do seem to be relatively consistent features in the data. So when we look, do we see something at the lithosphere-sinosphere boundary? So we might expect, based on tomography, that the lithosphere-sinosphere boundary would be somewhere in here. And no, we don't really see a strong and coherent negative phase at all. We see some relatively strong phases at shallow mid-lithospheric depths, but nothing from the lithosphere-sinosphere boundary range. And that tells us that the velocity gradient there must actually be quite gradual, because in order to not see a phase, the gradient must be distributed over something like 50 or 60 kilometers or more. Okay, so this is some examples of our work from the US. We've also seen similar results in Australia, but now let's look elsewhere for some examples. So this is a very nice study from Europe by Geisler et al. So this group of stations here is in the younger, more recently tectonized part of Europe, and then here are the more cratonic regions on this side. And here, these are S2P receiver functions, the MOHO phase, and then a negative phase interpreted as the LAB, which is quite strong in the Phanerozoic part of Europe. But once you get into the Eastern European craton, the amplitude of the energy from the potential LAB depth range really drops precipitously. Maybe there's a weak phase down there, but again, not a very strong and coherent arrival. Again, that would argue for a relatively gradual boundary or a weak velocity contrast. Okay, now there's one study from Europe that actually does argue for the presence of a fairly significant LAB beneath cratonic regions. So this is the new paper by Kind et al. This is going from Germany up into the Proterozoic and Archean cratons in Scandinavia. So beneath northern Germany, relatively strong lithosphere-sinosphere boundary phase. And then as you get into the Proterozoic terrains and then finally the Archaic terrains further in the north, they argue for the presence of both a mid-lithospheric discontinuity and some energy coming from the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary. So this would be a counterexample to, for example, what we saw in North America and Australia. Okay. Tanzania is actually a place where you do see a relatively strong lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary phase. This is the Wohlburnall study. This is now here. These are individual station-stacked receiver functions. This is the MOHO phase. This is a phase they interpret, at least in the craton, as a mid-lithospheric discontinuity at depths of, say, 60 to 90 kilometers. These are actually the same stations. You should just sort of imagine this box sort of appended to the bottom of this box here. So this is looking at the greater depths. These would be their lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary phase. This is actually a pretty coherent arrival. It's definitely weaker than the mid-lithospheric arrival. And these come from depths of somewhere between 160 and 220 kilometers beneath the center of the Tanzanian craton. Well, as a number of people have said, Africa may be an unusual case for cratonic LABs from the point of view that we do have, we have the African superplume, and there's also evidence for a very well-developed asthenosphere beneath Africa. This is a Rayleigh wave, fundamental mode Rayleigh wave, Rayleigh wave tomography study. This is showing an average absolute shear velocity profile beneath Tanzania with, for a craton, a very pronounced low velocity zone, and that might explain the larger LAB phases we see here. Okay, so just to summarize about the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary. So Phanerozoic continental regions, except for relatively small scale deviations, we almost always see something like a 4 to 6% velocity drop that's vertically localized over 20 kilometers or less. That is much too localized in depth to be explicable by a thermal gradient alone. When you look at typical thermomechanical models, the temperature gradients you get at the base of the lithosphere are nearly always distributed over length scales of 50 kilometers or more. This is some older work from Sarah Zoronic. This is an average profile beneath the continental upper mantle, average from convection models of Cooper et al. And you know, the increase in temperature is simply too gradual to produce this sort of localized 20 kilometer deep or a gradient that is localized at 20 kilometers in depth that we see beneath young continents. So beneath young continents, we really need something else in the asthenosphere, the presence of volatiles or a little bit of partial melt to produce this phase. However, in cratons, the absence of a lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary phase in many regions argues for a velocity gradient that's distributed over 50 kilometers or more. So in cratons, this very gradual kind of temperature profile by itself might be sufficient to explain both the combination of the receiver functions and the tomography. It's not ruling out other factors such as volatiles or melt. It's simply saying that temperature alone may be sufficient, though, of course, Tanzania and perhaps Northern Europe would be exceptions to that. Okay. So that's what I wanted to say about the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary. Now let's turn our attention to layering within the lithosphere. So I think an excellent point that has been made in a number of the talks that it's really important to integrate the results from seismological imaging with other geophysical data, petrological and geochemical data. You know, clearly that's of the essence. I would say, based on looking through the literature for all the different kinds of layering we see in the cratonic mantle, we also still have a lot of work to do simply reconciling the different kinds of seismological observations, because in many cases, studies from the same region give quite different structures, and we need to sort of figure out how to reconcile those because they should be saying the same Earth. So the reason this is interesting from a geodynamic point of view is what we can learn about lithospheric layering could constrain models for how the cratonic mantle lithosphere formed. So some of the candidate models that are out there is that the cratonic mantle is the residue of plume melting. Another possibility that's been proposed is that the cratonic mantle formed by the accretion of depleted subarc mantle. Third alternative is that the cratonic mantle is made up of imbricated segments of paleo slabs, or oceanic lithosphere that only partially subducted. And then a fourth alternative is one which has been mentioned a number of times today, as the model of Ioan Romanowicz, sort of drawing on the geodynamic modeling of Cooper et al., that suggests one could have an earlier formed chemically depleted layer, which forms the original stable core of the cratonic lithosphere, and then at a sort of later point in time, you have a thermal boundary layer which grows beneath it and then eventually becomes viscous enough to become part of what we would consider the cratonic lithosphere. So let's take a look at some of the different types of constraints we have on layering within the cratonic mantle. So this is now a clustering analysis done on the global model of Lekach and Romanowicz. So what you're looking at here are taking vertical profiles globally and clustering them into a set of six groups. And the cratonic profiles are those that are shown in green. So this kind of velocity profile, these are absolute shear velocities, occur in the regions where in map view you're seeing the green region. So these are the most of the world's continents. And what one tends to see is that overall the cratonic mantle lithosphere is high velocity, but at a depth of 100, maybe 120 kilometers or so, one does see a localized reduction in shear velocity. So that's one kind of layering, simply layering in isotropic velocities. There's a very nice correspondence with this result, and the really classic work by Thibault and his colleagues looking at the 8-degree discontinuity. So these are showing the first arriving P wave travel times from regions globally. I'd like you to focus on the green arrivals because these correspond to higher velocity arrivals from long-range seismic profiles in cratonic regions. And at a distance of about 800 kilometers, 8 degrees, one sees this offset in the first arriving travel times. And that can be explained by a drop in shear velocity. So please follow the light blue profile here showing shear velocity for these older, colder, faster regions that then corresponds to a localized reduction in velocity in this depth range here before velocities increase again deeper into the mantle. So, these two sets of results, I think, agree quite nicely. But let's look at some other kinds of layering. Okay, we also see layering in isotropic velocities. And there are many examples of this that I could show. This is a nice recent one from Scandinavia, from Pedersen et al. So here, we're looking at a profile through results from these temporary broadband arrays. Both in the Proterozoic and Archean regions. And these are summarized by these absolute velocity profiles here, which are color-coded. So the red absolute shear velocity profile corresponds to this group of stations. The blue absolute velocity profile corresponds to this group of stations. And these are corresponding profiles. For example, let's focus on this one here, south to north through the region, from the global model of Debye and Ricard. And what one sees is as you cross from the Proterozoic terrains into the Archean terrains, there's a big lateral change in the vertical layering in isotropic velocity. In the Proterozoic regions, a much faster lower mantle lithosphere, and in the Archean regions, a faster upper mantle lithosphere, and then a slower lower mantle lithosphere that these authors interpret as the results of metasomatism in the deeper part of the mantle lithosphere. So that's another kind of layering that we see. Still another kind of layering is layering in azimuthal anisotropy. So this is the work from Ioan and Romanowicz from North America. So as we look along this profile from A to A prime here, these correspond to these profiles shown in this part of the diagram, basically you see these layers everywhere in North America, but they're just nicely illustrated on this profile. And basically what you're looking at is the red regions show places where the orientation of the fast axis of azimuthal anisotropy is close to the direction of absolute plate motion. The blue regions are the layer in which the orientation of the fast axis of azimuthal anisotropy is highly oblique to absolute plate motion. And this is the basis for the model that suggests one has an earlier form chemically depleted layer, and so this fast axis of anisotropy is reflecting the deformation event that formed the chemically depleted layer. And then the somewhat deeper, and then over here at the edge, thicker blue layer corresponds to this later formed thermal blanket or thermal boundary layer. And then in this view here, we're looking at the gradients in fast axis orientation, and so these correspond to the transitions between the different layers of azimuthal anisotropy. And then down in the asthenosphere, this layer parallel to absolute plate motion is representing deformation in the asthenosphere due to relatively recent flow related to plate motion. Now, an interesting observation is that the depth of the boundary between the layers in the lithosphere corresponds to where receiver functions have seen negative phases. And I think an open question is the degree to which the receiver functions and these layers of azimuthal anisotropy are seeing the same thing. So, for example, here are some receiver functions. These are just single station stacked now. Receiver functions from the North American craton from our group, where we see the MOHO phase here. And then we see this negative energy here in roughly the same depth range where Yuan and Romanowitz get the transition in fast axis orientation. So one of the things we've been trying to model is the degree to which these two kinds of observations agree. And in some places, you can explain the receiver functions reasonably well with the Berkeley azimuthal anisotropy model. However, I would also note that in the receiver functions, there's actually a fairly wide depth range within these cratonic regions where you get negative phases. And 5 minutes? Thank you. And this would argue that there are other arrivals here and perhaps a more complicated structure. So what could that more complicated structure look like? Well, let's look at two regions where higher resolution data exists and where we don't have to look simply at single station stacks, where we can actually look at how things vary in three dimensions. Oh, sorry, there was one more azimuthal anisotropy study I wanted to mention. This is very nice work recently from Europe. This is, again, just showing a map at 50 kilometers in sort of northern Europe. So here we are in the cratonic regions of northern Europe. This figure here sort of fits into these maps here and here roughly. This is 75 kilometers and 125 kilometers, and essentially showing, again, layering in azimuthal anisotropy within the thick cratonic lithosphere. All three of these maps lie within the part of the lithosphere. This is now a shear velocity profile for the Eastern European platform, and then another one for the Baltic Shield. I think that comes from up here somewhere. So all of these are within the thick, relatively high velocity cratonic mantle lithosphere. Okay, so what do some of these more complex styles of layering look like in cratons? Well, this is a lovely study by Stéphane Rondinet and his group from 2009. This is from the Slave Craton. So here we have the outline of the Slave Craton in the Canadian Shield, shown in map view. And the seismic profiles here correspond to this blue line here. So these are north-south profiles. And what they saw in P to S receiver functions was this pronounced zone of negative arrivals, which corresponds to a low velocity zone. And this is very well correlated with a zone of high conductivity from MT data. And the interpretation of this feature is the combination of low seismic velocities and high conductivity is that this is a zone of remnant metasomatism from paleo subduction. And I believe sort of based on rhenium osmium dates, the sort of the preferred age for this would be somewhere back in the Archean, maybe sort of 3.5 billion years ago. But in any case, this, I think, is a nice example of perhaps a paleo slab, which is now frozen into the body of the cratonic mantle lithosphere. In another portion of the Slave Craton down here, beneath the Yellowknife region, this is an image from Bostock 1998. And here, these are anisotropic interfaces defined by P to S receiver functions beneath Yellowknife. And when then these are correlated back to the surface with the results of active source imaging from the lithoprobe program, again, these have been interpreted as evidence for paleosubduction. In this case, it's younger subduction, it's Proterozoic age subduction at the edge of the Archean slave craton. Okay, so this is the slave craton. Now, recently, we've seen some intriguing features beneath the Wyoming craton in the US. So again, here's the profile I showed you earlier here. So again, very strong and pronounced lithosphere sphenosphere boundary phase in the actively deforming western US. You get to the craton, not much of an LAB phase, but you do have these interesting arrivals which are robust within the sort of mid-lithospheric part of the craton. Now, what do these look like when we look at them in different views? So now I'm going to show you a profile that's going south to north through this region, and this is what we see here. So this is sort of energy coming from the Moho, but in the mantle we see these two very prominent negative arrivals, very coherent. We see one that is relatively flat at about 75 kilometers depth, and then we see a second arrival that starts at about 100 kilometer depth and dips gently to the north to a depth of about 120 kilometers. When we look at the absolute velocities from the shear wave tomography of Obrovsky et al., you can see that these are both in relatively high velocity mantle lithosphere, though the velocities are higher here. So what's going on tectonically here? Well, if we looked at the edge of the craton about 1.8 billion years ago, we would see the edge of the Wyoming province here. And then over the next interval in time, somewhere on the order of 1.676 to 1.72 GA, this is from the compilation of Whitmire and Kallstrom, Proterozoic terrains, in particular the Yavapai province, was accreted onto the edge of the Wyoming craton. So now when we look at this image, what we're seeing here is essentially the cratonic lithosphere of Proterozoic age from the Yavapai province that has been juxtaposed or accreted against the older Archean Wyoming craton. And I think, you know, it's not too much of a stretch to interpret this feature here as perhaps the top of another paleo slab that was involved in that collision. And again, the low velocities could be explained by a zone of mantle metasomatism on top of the mantle lithosphere. Okay, and I just want to make one more point and then I'm done. Which is, we can also appeal to other kinds of evidence for explaining where these arrivals come from. This just I found fascinating. So I don't know how many of you were aware that in September there was an earthquake at 80 kilometers depth within the Wyoming craton. And this is showing the location of the earthquake. This is in the body of the old, you know, Archean cratonic mantle lithosphere. This is not an actively tectonically deforming region. This is stable cratonic mantle, and it actually lies right at the location of this negative arrival, this mid-lithospheric discontinuity we see in the receiver functions. So what could this phase be? Well, I think one really intriguing notion is you can explain this using runaway shear instabilities in fine-grained olivine. This is a model from Kellerman and Hirth that actually they proposed a number of years ago to explain intermediate depth earthquakes in subducting lithosphere. So if you have mantle with a pre-existing fine-grained shear zone and you have ongoing viscous deformation, this can create shear heating within the fine-grained shear zone that essentially becomes unstable and increases and leads to rapid displacement that corresponds to these events, a drop in shear stress, an increase in temperature, and a rapid increase in strain rate and displacement at a very localized point in time. So that would be your earthquake. But why is this interesting for cratons? It's interesting because this mechanism only works at temperatures of about 600 to 800 degrees C, and this would be consistent with the geotherms we get from xenocrysts for the Wyoming craton. And let me end there. Thank you very much.